Without any more ado, I'd like to introduce Asia. She's from Alameda, and she's our Alateen speaker for this evening.
Hi, my name is Asia. I'm actually not an Alateen anymore. I am a young person in Al-Anon, and I'm really nervous. I always want to start out my story by telling you how I got into Alateen, but there was a little bit of time before that. I came in really early, so it's like I can't, it's kind of stretching back kind of far now to think about how it was before any of us got into the program, but I come from a family full of alcoholism and drug addiction, and then the people who aren't users of any kind are just really crazy, and I never knew that there was any kind of drinking or drug abuse going on in my family at all. It was just kind of whatever happened, I just accepted it, and I thought that was kind of normal, and I just thought there just always seemed to be something going on in the family. There was like always a drama, and there was always some big event, and there was always these wild characters and stuff, and it just seemed like that was the way people were, and then that was, you know, what happened in our family. And I never knew that people just didn't act that crazy unless they were under the influence of alcohol or drugs, or lived with someone who was under the influence of alcohol or drugs. So in my immediate family, my mother was a heroin addict, is a heroin addict, and kind of used alcohol as a backup. And my father he drinks a lot and he eats a lot and... but he hasn't gotten into a program or anything. I think he just kind of thinks everything is okay still. And then I have a stepfather who died of the results of his drinking and drug use. And he was, my mother and he were quite a pair. And we just kind of went along. I remember when I was little, I was... like half the time I was really scared of my stepfather and everything about him really scared me and I didn't trust him. And then the other half the time I really liked him and he was really nice, you know, he was daddy, he was great. And my mom, I just always trusted, but now that I think back, she acted like just really crazily too. She acted really irrationally and she had this wild temper and it was like the totally embarrassing kind where she'd like be out in front of the house screaming and fighting with whoever she was fighting with and, you know, making a scene in, like, public places, and it was totally humiliating. And you always had to just kind of slink out of wherever it was, you know, take the younger ones and just kind of slink out, and, like, it was just terrible, and it was always really, really frightening, too. She was, she's a screamer, and I'm glad that we never had, like, any kind of physical abuse or anything happen to us, never. But, God, the emotional impact of, you know, being with people who are, you know, in such rage is really strong. It's really strong, and it lasts a long time. And so I just always kind of remember that. And so half my childhood was great. You know, it was really nice. We lived in, like, a big hippie era, and we were going to marches and stuff, and we had, like, a big liberal family, and there was always people around, and that was really nice. And then the other half was, like, was violent and unpredictable, and I was just scared a whole lot, and so I'd always, like, be crying in a corner, or I'd be reading, or I'd do things to, like, make myself invisible. I really didn't want to be noticed a whole lot, so I just kind of took care of myself, and I started getting the idea that my parents are my parents, and I love them, and they were supposed to take care of me, but I knew that they couldn't really take care of me that great, and so I would just, you know, take care of myself. You know, I loved my mom, she's great, but, you know, I'm the one who's going to get me through my life. And I found that later that's the same kind of attitude that I had about my higher power, is that, oh, yeah, my higher power is great. You know, I love my higher power. It really will take care of me, but I really don't think it will, so I'll just do it myself. You know, it's there for the good times, but when the times are bad, I need to do it myself. And that is just... that's real interesting to see that now, because now my relationship with my parents has changed a whole lot, and so you know, I can see how my relationship with my higher power can change too. But it, you know, that initial reaction is always there, that I need to take care of myself. So when I was a child, things were just kind of strange. We lived with my grandmother for a little while, who's real crazy, and she just loves to take care of people, and the sicker the better, and the more problems they have, the better. You know, I think that she would really get a lot out of Al-Anon, but she probably would want to go and so she could take care of all these people who have all these problems. So I don't know if she's ever really going to get there or not, but things just started getting really bad at home. My mom was just out of control. It was like just fighting all the time, and my household was really crazy. And I stayed away from the house a lot at that point. This was like ten through 12. I came into the program when I was 11 and a half, and so right before that era, I was just never home. I was always over at my best friend's house, who also was really sick. But I call her sick now, but she was great then, and we had a really good time, and she was lots of fun. And so I was always over there, and I never really wanted to be around my house. And I'm glad I wasn't, because I just know that when I was there, there were some really bad times, and I'm really glad I got a little break. So my mom finally broke up with the person she was with at that time, and they were just hellacious. There was just fighting all the time, and just real, real crazy stuff. And she got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was like the biggest shock to me. I had no idea what she was doing there. I was like clueless, and the only thing I could come up with at the time was that the breakup that she was going through was so horrendous that the only place she could find emotional support was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's like kind of how I thought. That's how clueless I was, you know, that I would, that an alcohol, you know, alcoholic-based program, and I was saying, oh, but she doesn't have a problem with alcohol. And, you know, I don't know what I was thinking, but I wasn't seeing what was in front of me. So she went to this, she started going to all these meetings, and she was also in NA Narcotics Anonymous. And she would take us to meetings with her sometimes, and they were okay, but I was actually kind of bored a lot in them, because I was really young at the time, you know, and I just kind of hung out, and I didn't really listen to anybody, but I heard my mom tell her story once or twice, and I was, like, amazed, because it had nothing to do with anything that I knew. I was, like, it was, like, a whole other world. I had no idea that any of that stuff had gone on, and I was, God, it was just amazing to hear all this stuff. And then one of her friends finally suggested that we go to Alateen, that she take us to Alateen, because, you know, her daughter went and she really liked it, and she probably, you know, thought we'd like it there and it'd be good for us. So we went, and actually at that time there was an Alatot group in our town. So I went to Alatot because I was really young, and my sister went to Alateen, and it was really big at that time. The Alateen meeting was really big, and I would always hear them laughing and stuff, and they were just like piled all over, and I'd be in the Alatot group with, like, these kids, but I really didn't feel like a kid because I'd been taking care of myself for so long, you know, really responsible for myself for so long, that I didn't feel like a kid at all. I felt like I didn't have anything, I didn't relate to these children, you know, and I thought they were all really immature, and I'm like, what's going on here? So finally I just decided that I would just lie to everybody, and I'd tell them I was 12, and I was going to go into the big meeting. So I did that, and that was really nice, and I didn't talk for, like, 3 years, and I just kind of sat in there, and they were real nice, and they just let me sit in there, and I had this real, they were always talking about, not always, but a lot of stuff mentioned higher power or God or something like that, and I just had this real snooty attitude about that, like, come on, you know, what's with this, you know, and I just figured that I was going to be really tolerant, and I was going to just say, well, whatever they believe is fine, but I really don't believe in that stuff, So I hung around, and started going to some of the events, because all the kids were talking about, you know, the bash and this and that and, you know, conferences and this and that. And it sounded like so much fun, so I went, and I don't know, I just started becoming really open to these spiritual ideas. I just thought, you know, I don't know, it just kind of, I guess I just let my mind open up a little bit, you know, and stop being so judgmental. And I started thinking that it really would be nice to have, you know, something else to rely upon other than myself, because I think I was getting really tired of that. So I started forming this idea, but it really seemed kind of ambiguous, and I thought for a long time that was my problem, you know, that I didn't have a clear idea of what my higher power was, and that was my problem, you know, why I couldn't depend on it, because I didn't know what it was I was depending on. But since I made that connection, you know, between how I conceived my parents and, you know, and them taking care of me, and connected that to my idea of my higher power, I think it really doesn't matter what my higher power is. It's going to be me, and, you know, and how willing I am to just, you know, give it up. Just give it up and just depend on something else, let something else take care of me, and, you know, do the little stuff, do the footwork and stuff, and do the things I can, but the overall guidance, you know, the overall path in my life, you know, I really don't need to worry about that, and there really is something that's going to take care of me. And it's kind of the faith that's the key. The faith is the key, and the willingness is the key, and it's not what it is. That's the solution. It's just the attitude that's the solution. So that was a real big breakthrough, but I still was very, very shy for a long time. Checking my time. Okay, So like I said, I didn't talk for about 3 years, and I've noticed that over time, I've become a lot more outgoing than I was when I was younger. But in things that really matter to me, like any kind of group, you know, any kind of like 12-step program or school or anything kind of social where I just have to be me, you know, I'm not performing a task or anything, but I just have to be me, I still retreat back to that real shy stage, and it takes me a long time, and I feel so self-conscious about that I'm like not out there. I'm not like, it's a party, everything always feels like a party to me, you know, and it's a social group, and I feel like I'm, you know, well, why, you know, I've been in this group for so long and I'm so at ease in this group, you know, why can't I be like that everywhere? I just kind of came to accept that it just takes me a little while, you know. I just sometimes I can jump out there and it's great, and sometimes, you know, just sitting in my chair and not talking to anybody and maybe saying hi to one person is okay. You know, that's okay for the night. You know, I did a pretty good job. So I was like that when I was first in, except for at that time I didn't know it was okay to just sit there and be scared, you know. And it is okay to sit there and be scared. I think a lot of people are like that. So finally I started talking, and I don't know what happened. I guess I just got used to it enough, and I got used to the people enough, and I just started talking about what was going on, and it was great. And at that point, our group had gotten really small. It was doing one of those cyclical things, you know, where it gets really big, and then it gets really small, and then it gets really big, and just kind of goes back and forth. And so it was really small for a long time. But I hung in there, and I kept going, and I went to the groups, and I went to the big things, and went to the fundraisers and stuff. And my sister had gotten really active in committee work, and just, you know, started moving into, like, the bigger circles of service work and stuff, and so I kind of just tagged along, and it was a little disconcerting, because I didn't always have her hand to hold, you know, I didn't always have someone to hold on to, but I was always around, you know, I would follow, and slowly, I just started making my own friends, which was really good for me, and started getting a lot more friends. And outside of program life, it's really weird, because I always felt like that first type of person, very shy, very scared. I was very scared of people, and I just always felt like I was like some slug on the ground or something, you know, and that, you know, was all through school and even high school and stuff, when I was pretty much, you know, a different type of person. I was pretty outgoing. I kind of found my personality by that time. But I always thought of it as, you know, well, my life is the program, my life is this outside stuff, my family, stuff like that. School is just something I have to go to, and so, you know, I do it, but I don't, you know, I don't really show myself there. And it turns out that a lot of people had a completely different perception of me than I had of myself. They, you know, we did some little card thing or something in one of my classes, like my last year there, and someone had written down, like, this amazing stuff about me, that I was, like, popular and dressed really well and was really outgoing and was really funny, and I'm like, are you kidding? I almost fell out of my seat. So I think that's just all the stuff. That's the person I became in the program, and I hadn't realized that it was really showing in other areas of my life, but it really did. And so in the program, I had become just a really neat person. I was, like, doing, I was starting to do my own committee work and work with our district and service work and stuff and having lots of fun with that. And it was really fun to get things done. I liked that. I think I was a little domineering because I'm in this program, you know, and you just like to control everything and do it all your way and everything. And so that was like a little bit of it. But at the same time, since you know, getting out into the working world and stuff, I've seen that that we have so much more a tendency to like listen to each other in this program, you know, and be like really diplomatic and like have open minds and you know, listen to the feedback and stuff and like try and find, you know, a good way to do things together than God, a lot of other people, like especially people that I work with and stuff, I'm just like, I feel like, well, why don't you know this way? You know, why don't you know this way of acting? Why don't you know this way of getting things done? I mean, because to me, that's the only way I know. And it's just in the program, that's all I know. And they don't, and I think it just makes for a lot of unneeded, like, anger and stuff. You know, people just get really bent out of shape, and I just feel like, well, you know, that's the way they want to do it. I don't feel the need to, like, babysit people, because that's a big responsibility. It takes a lot out of you when you feel the need to be responsible for everybody and, you know, try and make them see things the way I want them to. You know, I just don't feel the need. Sometimes I get upset, but that is separate from me trying to, like, bend them into shape, you know, bend them the way I want them to. So I can get upset and I can feel upset when, you know, somebody hurts my feelings or, you know, something feels really inappropriate to me, but it doesn't have anything to do anymore with, you know, me acting on that and, like, trying to change them, you know, which is a relief because I can get upset and it can go away real quick, you know, I can talk about it. And basically all I need to do is talk about it a lot of times, you know, just get it out and it's gone and it's taken away. And whereas if I was, like, really thinking about it and trying to change it and trying to change this person along with it, I don't think it would ever happen and I think I would waste so much energy. It just takes so much out of me. So, That's a great thing that I kind of picked up here in the program. I love that. And so where was I? I was in the program, and I did creative work, and I did school, and then I got out of school. Oh, then I fell in love, and then, like, the true Al-Anon stuff came out when I fell in love. And, God, that was crazy. And now I know. It seems, I don't know what I don't know. Now, before it was like I was just like the child of, you know, family member of, but like when I am involved with someone, then it's like a whole other ballpark. Oh my God, it's just insane. And I, you know, now I feel like a true addict, you know. So that's been just a roller coaster. Lots of illusions smashed, lots of compromises and stuff, and you know, the way things I said I would never do, you know, I did, and things, you know, I said I would never put up for, I put up for, and I, you know, and it was just really hard. And I kind of think, well, that's how life is, you know. It's really surprising. I really hate that that's the way it is, but, you know, the more experiences I get in life, it just seems like nothing is like you thought it was, and everything is a lot more basic than you thought it was, and it's just, you know, it's kind of the same thing of just everything new that happens, you know. It's like, well, first thing I got to do is, like, let go of what I thought it was going to be like. And then, you know, think about how it really is, you know, and how much work do I want to really put into it, and how, you know, what do I really want to put into it, and what do I really want back, you know. And that's, it's, everything is just kind of a give and take, you know. Everything is work, you know, and I hate that. And, but that's what I've learned. And with this guy, I think we broke up about 5 times in 3 years, and now, I don't know, it's just different now. It just seems like kind of almost like how I had to wait and give myself a lot of time to get adjusted to certain groups. I've just kind of waited it out and just let myself adjust to this relationship too. It's like I acted a lot of ways I don't think was me, and now it's just a lot more comfortable, and I think it's a lot more give and take, and as long as I just hold on to myself, you know, which is a real hard deal for me to just not, you know, give myself up so that I can get my claws into this other person. And so that was a huge experience. And I don't know, things just seem to be, like, rolling along now. It's kind of like how life always is, you know. I'm real settled. I have my work. I've got a living situation for now, and everything's just always going to be changing, and I just kind of have to think about, you know, what I want to do next, and how much work am I willing to put out to get it, and then the flip side of that is, well, how much faith am I going to have that, you know, I deserve this, and whatever happens, you know, to keep having that faith. That's the hardest part for me. It's not like the planning, and it's not like the work, really. It's the letting go that's the hardest for me to not be worried, you know, because I guess worrying is the way that I hold on to it, worrying about it. And when I worry, some part of my head says, well, you know, then you have the right to worry about this because this is your responsibility. But it's not really. It's not, you know, I can do as much as I can do, but if I've done all I can do and I'm still worrying, then I'm holding on to it and I'm trying to change it, you know, and it's just not going to work out. I always get what I hate when I do that. And I worry because I feel like my higher power is just not going to get it right enough. You know, it's just not going to manage enough because this is too important. You know, that's what I always think. It's too important. You know, it doesn't understand. You know, it's got to be this and this and this and this. And you know, it's got to be, and I'm just going to be totally unhappy if it's not. So I do, you know, what I think I need to do without stopping and relaxing and acting on faith. And what I get is exactly what I didn't want. And it just always works out that way. And it's kind of frustrating, but that's the only way I learn things is, like, by pain, you know. So I'm learning to just kind of try it again. And I can keep, the best thing about it is that I can just keep doing it as long as I want to. I mean, I can keep making mistakes. I can keep banging my head. I can keep going through lots of pain as long as I want to because I know this program is not going anywhere. So I can, like, always come back and, you know, try it again, just like they said, you know, and anytime I want to, you know, come back, try it again, and it'll probably be okay. So I can just keep, you know, doing it my way until I get my fill, and I can always come back. So it's kind of funny how that happens. And so far, I've been in the program for 10 years, and I always thought, you know, that would mean something, but it doesn't really. Because when I first came in, I heard someone, an older Alateen, speak, and he was just right on the verge of his transition, and I thought, what, you know, 10 years, he came in really young too, and I thought, wow, he must really have it down. But what it turns out to be is that, well, no, because, you know, life is like cycles too. So it's like you can get recovered and get recovered and get recovered, and then all of a sudden it'll change direction, and you start all over again. You know, you're just right down to the bottom, just like you were before. Yeah, you've got all this recovery in one area, but now you've got a whole new area, you know, and you start over again, and then you get recovery in that area, and then you change again, and it's like you never become a fully recovered person, you know, ever. And but if there's newcomers here, just ignore that, you know. Yeah, it gets really great, you know. It gets really great and everything is solved, yeah. And so that's kind of what I'm finding out. And I've been hearing a lot of people talk lately about stick around for the miracles, which is kind of cool because sometimes I just feel so hopeless and I keep showing up and I don't have a lot of willingness and I, you know, oh, I don't want to be there. I want to do the easy way out. You know, I want to go fake out. I want to go just do something easy. And basically, even if you just show up, you know, it'll get you somewhere, get you out of that space if you keep showing up. And it's really cool to see that in people, you know, just keep showing up and who knows, you know, one day, you know, something great's going to happen and you'll be totally changed and you'll be the person you wanted to be, and the only way that's going to happen is if you just keep showing up. You know, it's not going to happen if I sit at home and watch TV, you know, watching cable or something. I don't think my higher power is going to get through to me too easily. So as long as I show up, it kind of helps clear out my head and makes me a little bit more open to the better person I could be. So I'm going to just wrap it up at that. Thanks.
A couple of months ago, Horace asked me if I knew of anyone that I thought would be real good in sharing this meeting, in sharing their experience, strength, and hope. And I said, oh, yes, I know a couple that is real good. And that is Jenny and Jerry. And so I've decided I asked who would like to go first, and it was kind of back and forth, back and forth. And so I said, okay, I will take the power out of all this. I'll take it and decide for the two of you. And so I'm going to ask Jerry to come up and tell how it is on the AA side.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jerry, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jerry.
And I want to thank everyone here in the Al-Anons for inviting me here to participate in recovery in this program. And Jenny can talk about this with some authority, I can assure you. I was the type of drunk. There are two types of drunks. The most prevalent kind you find in bars. And then you find the at-home drunk. And we're kind of in a minority, but that's what I am. I am a closet kitchen drunk. And I freely shared with Al-Anons my disease. And it's with some gratitude that I'm here to start to share in the recovery in this disease. And for me, it is a disease. That's not... When I first heard that, when I first got here, and I heard the disease of alcoholism, I thought in my cunning little mind, yeah, they want to say that so I'll feel better about myself. And I believed that, and I carried that with me for a long time. And I think that when I've talked before in front of an Al-Anon group up in Reading, and I don't want to share a whole lot about what it was like for me, okay? And the reason is that I passed out and blacked out through most of it, and you had to live through most of it, and it was not much different from any other common variety drunk. And And not only that, my drunken log is extremely boring. You know? I drank at home. I didn't go to bars. I was a weekend drinker, so I always made it to work on time. And a lot didn't happen. Okay? And an awful lot didn't happen. Okay? And my whole life was like that. I didn't dare a lot of things, and I didn't do a lot of things, and I was afraid to do a lot of things, and I came from a family shot full of alcoholism. Today, through the grace of God, out of a family of eight, there's seven surviving children, and out of those eight children, five of us are in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have two sisters with 21 years. I have a brother with 11 years. I have, thank God, our youngest sister with 6 months. And I can't tell you because I gave up on the youngest. And I don't mean that in terms I turned my back on her, but I just, that was a tough story. And she spent a lot of time drinking, and I couldn't watch her go down the tubes. And then she got recovery. And she got recovery a lot of the way that I got it. The lady I was married to and the children that were in that marriage had finally said, hey, we've had enough with you, goodbye, and they let me go. And one day, I was in the front room of a friend of mine's little apartment, going around in circles with terror, sheer terror going on inside of me. And I had not started drinking at my normal time that day. And I had a moment of clarity. Now, I drank that day. But somebody gave me a little juice glass, you know those little juice glasses? And they put about that much wine in the bottom of it. And that was my drink for the day. Well, I just touched off an atomic bomb inside, but there was nothing left to. There was nothing there to put the bomb out. And I had a moment of clarity on the way home. And I had that moment of clarity because I had talked to an alcoholic 2 years before who was sufficiently armed with the facts about herself. And she shared about herself. And that was my oldest sister. And 2 years later, I could no longer deny the slide that I was on. So I came to this program. Now, I came to this program because I was thoroughly whipped. And as a young boy, I experienced what it was like for an alcoholic to drink himself to death. And that was an old man that used to live two houses down from us. And he had just retired from the railroad, and he had been a periodic drinker for a long, long time. And he retired because he was too old to work anymore. And he took it all the way out. He was 75 before they could retire him, but they retired him. Anyway, he drank himself to death within a few months. Now, I knew, because as a kid, you're curious, so you look inside the house where they were at, and you can't believe what goes on, and except those who have experienced that. And it could be somebody here that has. But anyway, I knew what was to die of alcoholism. And I didn't want to die that way. And that was the reason I was willing to do whatever was asked of me at that point in time. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did, probably for the first time in my life, what they told me to do. And Asia talked about a little bit about it, that wanting to do it myself. And I had failed all my life wanting to do it myself. Damn near killed me. So I had to open up to other people. And for the first time in my life, I really did. I followed some directions. I was told to get a sponsor, and I did that. I was told to go to, back then, this has been a while ago, but back then they used to just tell you to go to meetings. You have to go to meetings until you wanted to go to meetings. And you went every day. Nowadays they tell you 90 and 90. But back then it was just go to meetings until it was no longer I have to go to a meeting, it was I want to go to a meeting. And that happened to me. I did that. It was suggested that I go to a big book meeting, a step meeting, and a closed men's meeting. The other four nights of the week, I was free to go to whatever meeting my sponsor thought I should go to. For the first year, I did not see the inside of an Al-Anon, of an Al-Anon club. And the reason that was, and he told me, he was very honest, he says, Jerry, you're the neediest bastard, excuse me, but you're the neediest person I have ever met. And you go in one of those places, you'll find what you're looking for, and then real disaster will strike, so you just stick with me. And it worked that way, because I was told not to get into a relationship, and I didn't. And it probably saved my life. Now, my sponsor was a big book thumper, a step Nazi, and an AA fanatic. He was all of those things, and that's exactly what I needed. The theme tonight is serenity in the family. What I did was I came to AA and I turned over to AA my drinking problem. And that's why I was here. I didn't want to drink anymore, and you guys are going to teach me how to not to drink. And my sponsor says, well, you got the first part of the first step, but you don't have the rest of it, and you're going to need the rest of it. Because the second part of the first step says my life is unmanageable. And he said, and in your case, Jerry, drunk or sober. And that was true. That was true. It was very true. In my case, alcohol was but a symptom of my problem. All my life, I had been... all my life, I couldn't accept that me as the way I was. Now, some people put it, I didn't belong here, or I was from outer space, or I just don't fit. I just couldn't stand myself, that's all. I couldn't stand myself. I just couldn't accept me for the way I was. And I had to be perfect. I had to be perfect. And if I couldn't be perfect, I couldn't accept anything less than that. And they brought me here and they told me that my sponsor told me I'd never be perfect. What he taught me, the first thing he taught me was all that I could expect for myself was a little bit of improvement each day. Okay? And that's about all I had in me at that time. And that was the best news I had at that time. All my life I figured if I made myself absolutely perfect, then I could present myself to God as I thought I understood him, or I could present myself to you people or anybody else. I had to be absolutely perfect. None of us, at least anybody I know, and sure as hell myself, I can't get myself all together in one moment, you know, just totally together. I can't. And I have to accept that. And I couldn't accept that. I could not accept that. And I jumped on that little bit of improvement. I figured I could do that. That I could do. Okay? And if I just gave a little bit of improvement each day, then I wouldn't drink. And I started getting involved in the steps. I got involved with my sponsor. I got involved with the Big Book. And I got involved in meetings and the people in the program. And but I was still hanging on to that old idea that what I was really here for was not to drink. And that was a lot of self-will on my part. And what I experienced for that is what I think every alcoholic experiences. When I live on self-will, strange things happen. And I had my first dry drunk. Now, this dry drunk, and I'd like to describe it a little bit because I think it's important. I think it's the kind of bottom that any one of us in this room can experience. And that is, I blacked out without anything, without any drinks, without any pills, without anything. One morning I woke up and I got a strange phone call from a friend of mine in AA, and they wanted to know, was I all right? And I says, yeah. And they said, well, you've been drinking. And I says, no. And they says, well, you called up last night and you didn't sound like you were sober. And I got real concerned because this person wasn't fooling around. This person was not fooling around. And so I went around and I looked for the bottles and I looked for this and I looked for that, and there was nothing. There was nothing in the house. Okay? And I got to thinking, well, she must have been, you know, mistaken. There must have been somebody else called her. And I was wearing my robe at the time, and I put my hand in the pocket of the robe, and there was my AA phone book. Now, I don't ever keep my telephone book in my robe. Never. And it suddenly dawned on me, yeah. You know. And what I had been doing, in amongst this sobering up, something else had happened. The woman I married to at that time, was a very, 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 very sick person. And exacerbating that sickness was drinking. And she crashed. And she left. And I had a house and two kids and a job. And I was a month and a half sober. And for the next several months, I did white-knuckle sobriety because I was in AA for my drinking problem and not for my living problem. Okay? And that's why I crashed. And that weekend I went to a retreat. I had a choice, go to a retreat or a nut house, and I decided to retreat. And and it was the best choice I could ever make. It was the best choice I could ever make. I made my first attempt at the third step in that retreat. Okay? But I needed to go through the second step. Now, in amongst all that, I found out one of the supreme basic for me in this program is two things. A little bit of improvement each day. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Now, for me, I don't believe I have ever been, quote, sane. I have always had, what do they say, two sandwiches short of a picnic, you know. My elevator didn't go up to the top floor, you know, it was too short, two floors short, you know. I just don't think I was ever an emotionally healthy person ever. Okay? So I learned some things about that second step. I learned that if I did the things I was supposed to do when I was supposed to do them, that I would feel better about myself inside. And that's the second cornerstone of a spiritual way of life for me. And I get to say this too, is that what you hear here tonight is my opinion. This is subject to change at a moment's notice. Especially when I start to learn some things, or if I have some insights into myself. But I started to get this feeling inside about feeling good. Okay, and I found that whenever I went to meetings, and whenever I took good care of my kids, and whenever I took okay care of the house, and I paid attention to my job, I felt good inside. And when I felt good inside, I didn't have urges to do crazy things. I didn't feel bad about me. I was acceptable just as I was. And I learned something in the program Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was I was going to recover. And that's an incredible feeling. I was going to recover. For the first time in my life, I was going to have something I had never had before. And that's why I said I don't think I was ever really sane. But I began to learn what sane felt like. What sane acted like. What sane thought like. And AA, they taught me to think. Because up to that point in time, I was not... I did well in school, but I was not a thinker. Anyway, the theme of this night is the serenity in the family, and I want to talk about that a little bit. I got sober on May the 5th, 1975. Okay, and one of the things I thought that as time goes by, you get it together. You know, you really get it together. And Asia again talked about it tonight. Life goes in cycles. I've had some real good times in this program. Real good times. And I've had some really tough times. And this is one of the tough ones. And some things have happened in my life. And one of the things I learned in this program was that the serenity is not the calm before the storm, nor is it the calm after the storm. It is the calm in the storm. Okay? We've all seen that. We've all heard it. About three times in my life, I have lived that. The morning of my first sober day, I had a moment of serenity. And that's what's kept me here ever since. I've wanted that. And it's like a carrot. And I stay here for that. You know, I really do. And today, I have some things going on in my life. They are situations in my life. And then I have to learn to live with those situations. I have to learn to accept. I have to learn that... Because these things are in my life doesn't stop. It needs to move on. You know, during the good times, and I've had a time leading up to this, it's been really good. And my life has kind of gotten on hold. You know, I'm just kind of dogging it. And I have learned in this program that I should never, ever, ever put my life on hold for any reason. For any reason. Life goes on. And it doesn't matter what's going on or what's happening and needs to move on. It talks about this in our big book, and I know this is an Al-Anon meeting, and I'm going to talk about a little non-conscious literature, but the chapter 2, The Family Afterwards, talks about this. It talks about, and I wish I could say it, I wish I had the book here with me, but I don't, but I wish I could quote it word for word. But what it says in there is in towards the end of that chapter, it talks about people who are ill are not happy people. And they don't play very much, and they don't laugh very much. But it talks about we need to go on. We need to continue on with our lives. Some of you here tonight are here without your spouses. Some of you are here tonight are probably here without some kids that may be out there right now. But life goes on, and you need to enjoy. We need to enjoy life. No matter what's going on, we need to enjoy life. We need to live life. I need to live life right now. And I haven't been doing that as well as I could. And I made some decisions about this. I'm going to move on. I want to get moving again. I want to get doing again. I'm 50 years old, and I need to go back to school. Because if I'm going to stay doing what I'm doing and enjoy doing what I'm doing, I'm going to have to go back to school. So I'll go back to school, you know. And there's some other things I want to do. I love my job, but, you know, sometimes I really get tied up with that thing, you know. What do I want to do with myself to, you know, where would I like to travel to? Where would I like to go to? What would I like to do, you know? There's more to life than just work and go home. There's more to it. There's a lot of things going on that I need to do, that I want to get moving on with. And school, I think, is an important one for me, but there's also some other things. And there's other things I want to play at, you know? I just want to get out and play. And it's funny. When I'm feeling better about myself, there is serenity in the family, you know. One of the things I learned here, and probably one of the most important things I learned here, was that when I am disturbed, there is something wrong with me. It's not her, it's not him, it's not them, it's not my lousy job. There's something wrong with me. When I was first sober, my sponsor, I had a problem with my job. I hated my job. And I had been going to the program for about a year and a half, and my job was really getting on my nerves. And every time I talked to my sponsor about it, he'd ask me, well, what are you doing about taking newcomers to meetings? Have you got any newcomers you're taking to meetings? Are you greeting people at the door? You know? And I want to talk about my job, and he's got this stone ear. It just nothing goes in, you know? So I says, okay, I'm going to show you. So I found me this guy. And he didn't have a driver's license, and boy, he was a sick one. He was a real sick one, you know? And I took him to meetings for at least 9 months, and God, did he 12-step me. Did he 12-step me. This guy never made it. He died out there. But he 12-stepped me. It was odd. I got into this guy, and he was exactly opposite of the kind of person I like. I mean, it was a chore going getting this guy, and it was a chore talking to this guy. But he taught me about he taught me about that part in the book that says there are some that just aren't going to make it, and it's not their fault. Grave emotional and mental disorders and the capacity, they don't have the capacity to be honest with themselves. He taught me those things, and he taught me that they're not at fault. He also took my mind off of me, and oddly enough, the job didn't change. Same job every day. The only thing that changed in there was I was no longer focused on myself, and all of a sudden the job wasn't all that bad. And a year and a half later, a better job came along. And I walked away from that. And that's the kind of thing that I came here to learn. That's the kind of thing I needed here. Jenny talks about this much better than I do, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. And that is, you know, I have that deep black hole in me when I got here. I've always had that black hole in me. And no matter what I've tried to stuff into that black hole, nothing ever worked. Alcohol, food, relationships, toys, anything. It just didn't work. It just never worked. I was never satisfied. And the last thing I wanted when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was a spiritual answer to my problem, to my problems, me. And that's exactly what I needed. And this program is a spiritual way of life. It's no longer enough that all that's expected of me is a little bit of improvement today. That's not enough. If I'm going to lead a spiritual way of life, it's a demand. I have to give a little bit of improvement each day. And I don't. There are times when I just, you know, whatever, laziness, stubbornness, whatever it is, and then I go starting paying the price for it. And the price can be pretty heavy. But like anything else in this program, my sponsor taught me that it just doesn't have to be that way if I don't want it. It's my choice. It is my choice. And so serenity in the family today is for me, my choice. And for the rest of the family members, it's their choice. And if I'm out of whack, that doesn't mean I take away their serenity. It's just I've let mine go somewhere. And they can be as serene as they want to be. And the same goes for me. You know, we can be in that place where maybe somebody doesn't want to play. But that doesn't mean that I have to stop playing. I can go out and play. And I can go out and do those things that I need to do for my soul. And I've overstayed my welcome here, and I want to thank all of you very much. Bye.
I'd like to introduce Jenny. I've known Jenny for quite a few years, and she's very dear to me. And when I asked her, she said, "Oh, I don't know." And I said, "Oh, yes, you can." And she says, "How come you didn't volunteer yourself?" And I said, "Well, I could volunteer you instead." So I'd like to have the Al-Anon side of that family now. Here's Jenny.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jenny, and I'm very happy, Elena. Now I'll tell you the true story. And this is of what Nadine said, because when she asked me if I would chair, I said, "Gee, I don't know." And she said, "Well, you'd better, because we already have the flyers printed." This is real hard, because Asia and Jerry just did a tremendous job, and I really enjoyed listening to both of them. It was really funny. I mean, the flyer has been sitting in my refrigerator for a month now. And it wasn't until today that I saw the title. No. That's what you call nerves. And the family serenity. I need to go back to my childhood and tell you when I felt that I developed the disease of the ism of the alcohol. Boy, I need to start over. The ism that I developed from the disease of alcoholism. Because I'm a firm believer that alcoholism is a contagious disease. And then as a child, I caught this disease. And as an adult, I still carry it around. And that's one of the reasons I keep going to meetings. And I go to meetings 3 times a week because I need 3 meetings a week to keep Jenny sane and happy and serene. And that's real important to me. I came from a real violent household. There was a lot of alcoholism in our family. I had lots of aunts and uncles that drank a lot. I had a father and a grandfather that drank quite a bit. And I need to tell you that these are the people that were the center of my life. I adored the ground they walked on. My father and my grandfather both did crazy things when they drank. When they didn't drink, they were pretty sane. And I hate to say it, but my mother was not sane. My mother was a rageaholic. My mother was the one, I felt, even as a child, that needed to be taken care of and to be pampered and to be calmed down. One of my earliest memories is of walking along, watching the fireworks in a distance. I must have been about 3 or 4 years old, with my mother telling me, "You really don't mind going to my aunt and uncle's house, do you? Wouldn't that be better than watching the fireworks?" And what it was is my dad and her had gotten into a big fight. Dad had come home drunk, and the beatings had started because Mom didn't keep quiet. Mom was the type that had to pester and had to make a scene. And when she did, my father would eventually beat her up. And we were walking away, and I was thinking to myself, you know, I really want to see those fireworks. But that's when I also knew that I had to take care of my mother. And that's when I first felt the ism of the disease. And I became a caretaker to all of those around me. I would take care of you and everything would be better. That's all I had to do, is make sure that you were happy and my life would be okay. If I could smooth these troubled waters, I would have a sane household. My dad quit drinking when I was about 11 years old. And what is really funny is our household didn't change that much. You know, my dad was a very passive person. My mother wasn't. And to this day, my mother is 80 years old, and she is still this way. She still wants us to take care of her. She still wants us to rescue her. And thank goodness with Al-Anon, you know, I don't need to do that quite as much as I used to. My love for alcoholics started then, you know. They were really exciting. And there, really, there wasn't too many boring times when they were drunk, you know. Because it always started out as a good party. And needless to say, it didn't stay there, but it started as a party. So when I got to be 15, I was raped. And what was really hard about this, I still have a problem talking about this, and it's real important that I do talk about this, because it showed how crazy I was in those days. Because we kept secrets in my family, and I didn't go home, and I didn't tell them what happened. My father had been ill for quite some time with a heart attack and stroke, and I knew that I couldn't go tell him. I had to keep this to myself. And what was really, really strange was the fact that I married this man two months later. And that's pretty sick. And to me, that's what the disease of alcoholism, it's a sickness. And I developed that sickness, and I carried it with me. This man was terribly exciting, because he was drunk most of the time. And at 15, I still wanted the sick excitement, because I knew how to react. And I knew deep down inside, see, my marriage was going to be different, because my mother had been the rageaholic and she would not leave my father alone. She had to be in his space all the time. And I knew that all I had to do was get into a marriage and I could do it differently. I could make this marriage work, and I was going to show her how to do it. You know? And he continued to rage. I lived in this marriage for 5 years, and in those 5 years, it was a very violent marriage. We had 3 children. And here again, it was like being my parents all over again, because the beatings had started once again. And I kept my secrets, and I didn't tell my family, and I didn't share with the neighbors, and I didn't tell my friends. You know, we kept the doors locked, we kept the drapes closed, and I kept the phone off the hook so the bill collectors couldn't call, because they did. And this was my life, and this was my family life, and this is what my 3 older children had to live with. I left that marriage, I was 19, and I had those 3 kids, and on the day I left, I knew that if I stayed 1 minute longer, I was going to kill this man. And then I killed my children and myself, because there was nothing left of Jenny. The disease of alcoholism had just like, it had eaten my soul up, and there was nothing left. And I talk about the secrets I kept, because I still kept secrets. My son and grew up for his first year of his life, he ate bread and eggs. And I don't like to talk about this. And the reason he did that is because once a week, my dad would stop at the bread store in the egg ranch on his way over to visit me, and he would drop these off. And I would never tell my dad, "Dad, could you buy me something else? We really need it. We have no food in the house." And I couldn't do that. This was me doing this. This was not the alcoholic. This was me. This was my illness doing this. I had to go back and make amends to my children, and I had to talk about this with my kids, you know. Your father didn't do this, kids. I did it. The disease of alcoholism did it. And we all shared it. And there was no serenity in our house. There was a lot of fear. I had a 3-year-old daughter, and when she was 3 years old, could read the clock, and 5 minutes before her father was due home, she would take her brothers, and she would go put them in their cribs. And they would all stay there until the next morning. Because even at 3, she was saner than her mother. Because I stayed there, and I faced him. And I said, "If you'd only quit drinking, everything would be okay." Not knowing that I was the problem in my children's life. The father, he came home and he drank. But I was the one that was keeping the secrets. I wasn't putting anything out in the open where we could look at it, where we could deal with it, where we could get better, where we could, the healing could start. When I left him, I swore up and down I was never going to ever get near a drunk in my life. And so I promptly went out and found somebody that didn't drink and he didn't use. And I made damn sure he wasn't going to drink and use, because I told him he wasn't going to. Because I said, "Now, by God, I paid my dues, and I'm not putting up with that anymore." That marriage lasted about 10 years with my control. And here again, though, I kept my secrets and I didn't share. You know, I had never been taught to be open with anybody. And I kept a lot from this man. And there, I had to make amends to him. You know, I had to make amends to both my ex-husbands, because I had to tell both of them, "I married you for the wrong reasons. You know, I didn't share, I didn't give. I wasn't part of." This man was totally wrapped up in himself. He might as well have been a drunk, because he couldn't do anything either. This was a boring period of my life, I guess. One thing about it is I was getting crazier by the minute and never saw it. Because, you know, when you don't talk to people and you don't share things, you don't see things. And it was strange, but I had a person over for dinner one night, and the phone rang. And it was my first ex-husband. And I hadn't been around this man in about 13 years. I'd had no contact with him, because when he finally left, he left. So we'd gotten no child support, no letters, no visitation, and nothing. And everything was fine. When I got off that phone, I was feeling what I call the terrors. All of a sudden, I had all the memory, I had all the fears, I had all the horrible feelings that I had 13 years ago that I thought, when I divorced that man, I left those. I mean, I didn't I get rid of my problem? You know, and everything was better. And that's when I realized, you know, I hadn't left him. I had carried him on my back for 13 years with me. And I had continually shared that disease of alcoholism once again with, now I had 5 children to share it with. You know, I was always real generous. You know, and this person sitting across the table from me said, "Yeah, there is a program to help you." And I said, "What's that?" And he says, "It's a program called Al-Anon. And would you like to go?" You know, I had never, ever heard the word Al-Anon before. I think the kids of today are so lucky because Al-Anon is advertised on TV. It's in the papers. We're getting it to the schools. I think this is tremendous. I had never heard it. And this person came and he picked me up the next week, and I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. And I sat there and I looked at these people, and I saw people crying and I saw people with smiles on their face, and I thought, you know, I want what they have. And what they had were no frown marks here. You know? I had walked around with these frown marks for years and years and years, and they didn't have them on their face, and that's what I wanted. They told me to keep coming back, and I was like Asia. I didn't talk. I just sat there, and I bolted for the door the minute it was done with. You know? It took me several years before I could really feel comfortable in the rooms of Al-Anon. But one thing I did is I kept coming back no matter what. It was a few years after that that Jerry and I married. And most of Jerry's story is true. We were all mutual friends, and we used to sit around and discuss Jerry H. and his drinking problem. And by this time, my five children and I were on our own, and all of a sudden, we were really on our own. My second marriage was falling apart. My father, who I dearly adored, was dying. My husband at that time, or soon-to-be my ex-husband, had cleaned out our savings account, our checking accounts, put our house up for sale, and Christmas was right around the corner, and we had nothing. And I hadn't worked for 15 years. I had quit school when I was a sophomore. I had stayed home with all those children. And all of a sudden, I was faced with reality. And all I did was I kept going to meetings. In those days, I went to 7 meetings a week. How I did it with 5 kids, I don't know. I look back and I have no idea how I got to those meetings. I don't know how those kids got taken care of or what. This is where my higher power really showed its stuff. You know, he really took care of us. They told me that all I had to do was keep coming back. I had to do the footwork and I had to listen. And that's what I did. And gradually, even in those days, some serenity was coming. You know, my higher power has a sense of humor. And he also knows that Jenny is about the most stubborn person around, and it takes a 2x4 hit on the side of my head to make me pay attention. You know, and I look back to all those things that had happened to me because we didn't know where the next meal was coming from again. And they told me, all I have to do is keep coming back, and I would get everything I needed in life, not necessarily what I wanted. And one of the first miracles that happened when I came to Al-Anon, and one of the first times I saw some serenity and sanity with my family, was with my children. At this time, I had them in junior high and high school and on down. And we got a knock on the door, and somebody had turned our name in to, in Milpitas, it's called the Jack Emery Drive, and at Christmas they take boxes of food around to needy families. And there were 3 high school kids at the door. And these are children that went to school with my kids and had gone to school with them for years. And I saw my children be able to open that door, put a smile on their face, say, gee, come on in, we'd sure need this. They put it on the table and they felt no shame. And all they did is they felt thankfulness. And that was one of the first miracles. And even though I had only been in Al-Anon for 3 or 4 months, the program was already spreading to my children. It was spreading to our family. My children were just thankful that they had food on the table and they didn't have to keep the secrets that I had kept. No, I think that they got the program long before I got the program. Mm-hmm. About this time, I'd always said all my life that I would die if I ever lost one of my children. And my ex-husband child-napped one of my children. He was a 7-year-old at a time, and he took them out of state. It was 2 years before I heard from this child again. And you know, I didn't die. I just kept going to meetings. I kept doing what they said. I kept reading the books. I kept going home every night, and I kept doing those dishes, and I kept cleaning that house, and I kept taking care of those other 4 kids. You know? At times, I didn't know where the next meal was going to come from. I didn't know how I was going to pay the rent. I didn't know where I was going to live. And you know, everything turned out exactly the way it was supposed to. The next miracle I think that happened was the day before Christmas. I get a call from a company that had told me 3 months before, gee, Jenny, why don't you go to school and come back someday and maybe we'll use your services? And they called me the day before Christmas and said, would you like to start work the day after? You know? That's my higher power taking care of me when I couldn't take care of myself, you know. There were still days in those first few months that people would say, Jenny, have you eaten? When was the last time you ate? You know, and I couldn't tell them. And they led me and said, okay, now sit down, you got to eat. No. I always knew I took care of the kids, and I knew I fed them, but I didn't know if I was taking care of myself. Through our divorce, I ended up with none of the furniture and all the bills. And I sent my children, school was out now, and the house was gone, and I sent my children all over the United States to relatives because I had nowhere to put them. We had no home, we had no money. I was making minimum wage at the time, and the next miracle happened. It was getting close to September, and my kids called and said, "Mom, when are we going to come home?" And I said, I don't know. I guess you'll come home when you're supposed to come home. It was about 2 weeks before Christmas, or before school starts, and I see the house advertised in the paper, and I go over and I look at it, and I call the agent, and she said, "Well, go by and see it. If you really like it, come talk to me." I went down there. It's exactly what we did. Anyway, after seeing me, and I told her flatly, "I can barely make the rent. This is what I'm making. These are where my children are. No, I don't get child support." She rented me the house, and here it is. It's another miracle because she was a real estate agent that needed a tax shelter. She rented the house at half the rent, at half the house payment, and I moved in. I had no furniture. I had no beds for my children. I had no sheets, no towels, no dishes. I moved in the house 2 weeks later. I had four of my children at home, and I had a full house full of furniture and a full house of kitchen utensils. And all I needed to do was quit telling secrets. Yeah, keeping secrets. I went out and I told people, "Hey, I got a house, but I don't have any beds." You know? And I got the beds, and we stayed in that house. And all of a sudden, we started to be a family. You know, I started to talk to these kids. I started to work the steps of this program. You know? I started to develop a relationship with a higher power. And Jerry talks about this black hole. And like what I like to say about my black hole is that I searched all my life to fill this black hole in me. And I filled it. I tried to fill it with marriages and lovers and children. And nothing filled that black hole. And when I went to these meetings and they talked about this higher power, which I had given up a long time ago because the God of my choice never got anybody sober. So I said, "The hell with you. If you can't get them sober, I don't want anything to do with you." And there was a lady sitting across the table from me that talked about her higher power that sat on her shoulder. And she said, "All I have to do is say, okay, do something because I can't take it." And she says, "But when I want to be in control, I just brush them off." And I thought, "Nah, I understand this woman." So I asked her to be my sponsor, and she agreed, and then I promptly ran out of the room. I didn't talk to her for a while. But what she did is she loaned me her higher power, and she took her hand and she moved her God from her shoulder and put it on my shoulder. And I call that God George. And he is still George to me. And he sat on my shoulder for a long time, and it was real convenient because I could talk to him. And all of a sudden one day when I realized I had really done my third step, is I realized George isn't on my shoulder anymore. He's filled that black hole in my heart. And I don't have it anymore because I searched all my life for a spiritual answer, and I had to come here and get George before I ever found it. You know. And so when I started to develop this relationship with George and being able to turn things over and to be able to share things with people, with my children, we started to get a little bit of serenity in our life. Not a lot, just a little. Things started to get a little bit better. Now, I'm not saying everything was perfect and these kids turned into angels, because they didn't. Because it was about this time that my middle child was getting into drugs. When Jerry and I married, and you put, at this time, and by this time, we had six kids all the time, and we had that seventh kid periodically. It was real chaos. One thing is, we had a three-bedroom house and one bathroom, and it was real chaotic. But there was real serenity in that house, too. And then eventually, we had three children that had drug problems. And with the help of these rooms, we were able to walk through those times of crisis. You know, we didn't turn into the rageaholics that we used to be. I didn't need to keep it a secret anymore. I could go to meetings and saying, you know, my heart is breaking. My son's in jail again, and I don't know what to do about it. And those people told me, like they did Jerry, go find a newcomer. Go do your dishes. I kept saying, what do my dishes have to do with drug addiction, you know? You know, and I found out it has everything to do with it. Because all I have to do is the footsteps. I only have to show up every single day, you know. And if I feel some serenity, eventually it gets to my children. My children all chose not to go to Alateen, which is something that, well, we sentenced one to Alateen for a few weeks, but it didn't work. He didn't get sober there either. No, because I still have the ism of the disease, you know, and I still want to go out there and I still want to fix. This child continued with, my middle son continued with his drug abuse until he was in his 20s, until I totally released him and let him go his own way. And the day I released this child to kill himself any way he chose, because I couldn't stay at home any longer to watch this, was one of the days that I got some real serenity. You know, it's the day I let him, gave him up to his higher power of his choice. You know, my higher power has one path for me. And my children's higher power has a path for them. And they have to go their own way. And I can be serene in my knowledge that they're going to be taken care of. He had to drink and abuse to the point that he was having seizures and he was in and out of hospitals before he got sober. And I had nothing, absolutely nothing to do with that miracle. You know, we talk about handing over our children, handing over our spouses, handing over all these other people in our life. And I called him one day and I said, your dad, Jerry's AA birthday is coming up, May 5th. Are you going to come over for the party? And he says, oh, yeah, Mom, that's my birthday. And I says, yeah, Mark, no, yours is in August. This is Dad's birthday, his AA birthday. And he says, I know, Mom, I'm going to have a year. You know? I have no idea. You know, that's when I knew I had released this child over to his higher power and let his higher power work the miracles because I couldn't work them. You know, I don't need to. On the way over here tonight, I turned to Jerry and I said, well, gee, before we get there, we better agree on something. Do we have serenity in our family? No. You know? And most of the time we do. You know? Most of the time we have serenity. Jerry touched on it a little bit, that we are going through a real bad period of time in our family right now. And it's a real growing process for me. You know, a real growing learning process. You know. Because the first thing I do is I call my sponsor and says, I've got this tremendous problem and I need to sit down and I need some time. You know, and if you're not available, please tell me because I'm going to find somebody that's going to help me. You know, I couldn't do that years ago. I wasn't taught to do that when I was a child. You know, you taught me how to share. You taught me to reach out to you so you could heal me. You know, I'm always my own worst enemy. I can't help myself without your help. I need to touch a little bit on the serenity that my children have gotten, some of the program that they get. This one son, that we're having problems with our youngest son right now, you know, and I hear things out of him like, Mom, all I have to do is one day at a time, you know. All I have to do is turn it over, you know. Mom, you think maybe you need a couple more meetings this week, you know? He's not trying to take care of me. He's trying to take care of himself. He's trying to hold on to his own serenity and to keep himself together to walk through what he needs to walk through. And as a family, I think we are serene. You know, Jerry and I give each other space. There are times when I tell him, I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to be by myself. You know, it's not your problem. It's me. Let me work it out. You know? We're a firm believer in the 30-acre rule. You know, he has his 10 acres. I have my 10 acres, and we have a 10 acres in between that we share. And that's all. He has his program, I have mine. He has his higher power, and I have George. No? I kind of like mine better than his, but... One of the things I think that I found why we have a serenity in our family today, in our family unit, is the fact that I accept my children for exactly what they are today. We have a daughter that lives in Florida who is married to a young man that we haven't approved of since he was in high school. Yeah. And you know what's neat is we just got back from visiting him and we had a great time because we said, you know, he's just the way he is. And she loves him, and isn't that the important thing? And it's not my business. And we went and had a great time. And the minute I got out of his being or controlling of him, he was okay, and our visit was okay. The minute I get in there and want to change you or make you different or make you what I want, it's no good. No, I have to accept you the way you are. This child that went through all the drug problems today, I see him periodically, at least 3 times a year, and he lives in Santa Fe. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that I don't love him less than I love my other children. It just means that, you know, he's a real loner. He always has been. And I can accept him for that, and it's kind of nice. Because, you know, in turn, they give me unconditional love. They don't say, gee, Mom, you've got to be a certain way. And I don't tell them, gee, son, you've got to be a certain way. You know, I love you just the way you are today. What I'm reading here is my notes that I haven't looked at since I stood up here. Today I think I can handle any situation, and it won't paralyze me. Now, that doesn't mean that I will be without fear, because that's not it. I will always walk through most situations with fear. But today I can share, and I can hold out my hands, and I can ask for help, and I can walk through everything. And before I close, I'd like to read just one sentence from the All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. Because I really like that, but there's one sentence in there that I think really hits me as the Al-Anon family group, because that's what we are, because I feel like I am part of that family. And it says, when you go out into the world, watch out for traffic, hold hands, and stick together. And I think that's it. Thank you very much for letting me share.